Okay, Whitehead's book, Science and the Modern World. It's not his major piece. It's not a statement of his developed metaphysics, except in terms of certain segments of it towards the end, when those ideas do come out in a highly condensed form that is very difficult to understand if you haven't read the larger work, Process and Reality. I'm referring to chapters 9 and 10, which I did not assign for that very reason. They're very hard to understand. But I've asked you to read this book for the primary reason that while it introduces Whitehead, it does so in historical terms. As you've discovered, the first 7 or 8 chapters are about the historical relationship of science to philosophy. So that really it's an account of science in the modern world in relationship to modern philosophy. And as such, I think, is extremely helpful because, as I'm sure you've observed, it's just impossible to talk about the history of philosophy without talking about the history of science. And so this provides some help in that regard. He sees philosophy as having a twofold task. He states this explicitly in the introduction to Process and Reality, his systematic work, the twofold task of philosophy. There is a critical task, and there is a speculative task. Now, that's the case with philosophy generally in any regard. Criticism of speculative ideas. Criticism of theoretical constructs. To see if they are coherent, consistent, empirically adequate. And incidentally, those are the criteria he always works with. Empirical adequacy. Does it cover all relevant information? Empirical adequacy. And rational coherence. Not just logically consistent, but does it provide a unified and comprehensive scheme? Coherence. So critiquing is one of the things, and in relationship to the history of science, it's the critiquing of scientific abstractions. The critiquing of scientific abstractions. And you see that at work in the first 4 or 5 chapters of the book. He's critiquing the theoretical abstractions of mechanistic science, what he calls mechanistic philosophy. The second speculative function, of course, is the positive function of philosophy, to propose more consistent, more empirically adequate speculative theories, extrapolating. Now, these two functions of philosophy are very characteristic of the way in which philosophers describe what they're doing, whether an introduction to philosophy texts or whatever, for the first 3 decades of this century. 1900 to 1930, 1935, this is the way it was. What happened after 1935? The rise of logical positivism. Therefore, with a rejection of metaphysical speculation. And so only the first function remained. which gradually came to be spoken of as the analytic function, and so analytic philosophy. The analysis of arguments and concepts and theories for their logical structure and empirical adequacy. You see. But with the demise of logical positivism, and all we have now is its vague ghost lurking behind in other disciplines than philosophy, it's died out in philosophy. With the demise of logical positivism, speculative metaphysics is now alive and well. And some of you, I don't know if any of you are, but some of you or your colleagues are taking a seminar this quad on contemporary metaphysics. Very contemporary, you'll see. But in any case, this is the way philosophy was conceived in those early decades of this century. Now, as you read into this book, Science and the Modern World, the first note that strikes you in that beginning chapter is what he calls the basic presumption of science, the basic presupposition of science, which he calls the order of nature. The order of nature. In the second chapter, it turns out that he's discussing the mathematical order of nature, because it was the rise of modern mathematics that was particularly significant in the 17th century, particularly. So the order of nature. You notice, I hope, that while he calls it a mathematical order, or if you like, a logical order, he also calls it an aesthetic order. Keep that in mind. As I mentioned last time, he seems to have an aesthetic theory of value. That is to say, all values seem ultimately to reduce to aesthetic values. Truth is valued for its aesthetic satisfaction. Goodness, moral value, contributes to the aesthetic harmony of the whole. It's important for that reason. So he has an aesthetic theory of value. So he's saying, in a sense, that this is a value-laden order of nature. That values are not simply utilitarian. Usefulness of things. Value is not something that we create and add, bring to nature. Nature itself is value-laden. And so he speaks of the aesthetic order as being an ideal for the future. Inasmuch as this is a process philosophy, the process is directional. What direction? To the achievement of value. That ideal, you see. So it is a value-achieving process, laden with the possibility, the potential, but a value-achieving process, a teleological process. And it's that notion of a value-achieving natural order that makes Whitehead so revolutionary in comparison with modern science and earlier philosophy. A value-achieving natural order. So you can anticipate then that the general theme of the book will be to critique the kind of supposed natural order which is value-free, bare, blind fact, blind process, causal mechanism without rhyme or reason. You see? He's going to be critiquing that. And at the same time, tracing the developing case for the kind of teleological view that he has. Now, in both the critical and the speculative function, he has not only sort of criteria for judgment in terms of empirical adequacy and rational coherence, he has those, but he has two points of reference. If you're talking of empirical adequacy, what sorts of experience are most significant? And his points of reference are, of course, developments in modern science. But he's perfectly aware that modern science is simply dealing with further scientific abstractions. You see, what makes the abstractions of modern science any better than the abstractions of mechanistic science? So it's not simply modern science. The other point of reference is what again and again naive experience, concrete experience. And that comes out in the kind of example that we were using in explaining his conception of the event, where the example was simply the concrete experience of perceiving, the perceptual event, where his phenomenological description, you see Hegel's phenomenology, his phenomenological description of a self-conscious perceptual event, no, of a perceptual event in a self-conscious being, is the lens through which he is able to see everything else. You see, that's the paradigm. Switch the metaphor. Now, that's a case of concrete experience. And you'll find that again and again he recurs to concrete experience. That is why he has that delightful chapter on the romantic reaction that's loaded with poetry. You see? Because he takes it that that poetry is dealing with concrete human experience, not with theoretical abstraction. You see? But it's capturing the experience. And so he takes it that the romantic poets like Wordsworth and Shelley are reacting against that aesthetically sterile universe of mechanistic science. So his chapter is called The Romantic Reaction. Reaction against what? Well, it's the reaction against the sterility of that mechanistic worldview from the standpoint of what the Romantics regard as concrete human experience, and right ahead with them. So if you think that Romanticism died out with the 19th century, well, not in the case of Whitehead. Not in the case of a lot of others as well. But this comes through very plainly. Now, let me illustrate that general tale that I've been telling. Turn, if you will, to page 18 in the book. Page 18. Incidentally, he speaks in one place of Christianity as a religion in search of a metaphysics. A religion in search of a metaphysics. What he means is that the metaphysical systems which have been pressed into service are inadequate. What Christianity needs is a more adequate metaphysic. And I think that granted his conception of Christianity, which you remember is that of the Galilean peasant, remember that phrase? It's the Galilean Jesus. Granted that conception of Christianity, he sees his metaphysic as the metaphysic for which Christian religion may be looking, you see, which may account for the process theology that has come out of it. But in any case, look at page 17. Did I say 17? Well, I'm saying 17 now anyway. okay. About a third of the way down the page. There persists throughout the whole period, and he's talking about 16th, 17th century, the fixed scientific cosmology which presupposes the ultimate fact of an irreducible brute matter. Irreducible brute matter. That stuff. Something. You know not what. Okay. Spread throughout space in a flux of configurations. In itself, such material is senseless, that is to say, unconscious, valueless, purposeless. Okay? It just does what it does, following a fixed routine imposed by external relations which don't spring from the nature of its being. That phrase, external relations, watch. Because an external relationship between A and B, as he says, does not spring from the nature of a thing's being. In other words, they're artificial relationships imposed on A and B, incidental, which leave A and B essentially the same as they were before. The classic example of that is Descartes' mind-body relationship. So the mind is a separate entity with its own function entirely separate from, and able to function quite independently of, body with its mechanical functions. You see. So external relations. He's going to be arguing for internal relations, which obviously are the opposite of external relations. So internal relations are relationships that pertain by virtue of the essential nature of A and B. You see, A has to be defined in terms of its relationships. That's what constitutes A. You see? Yeah, what constitutes a servant, or a master? You've heard of the master-servant relation, I think. You see? What constitutes a servant, or a master? But the relationship. You see? So he's picking up on Hegel's conception of internal relationships within a process. And he's going to be, as he says, transferring that into a naturalistic context. Okay, external relations. It's this assumption of a valueless, purposeless, senseless matter following a fixed routine imposed by external relations, the mechanistic universe. It's this that I call scientific materialism. It's an assumption I'll challenge as being entirely unsuited to the scientific situation at which we've now arrived. And you find that he immediately goes on to indict Descartes. Well, turn over to page 18, and halfway through the page you have this. A little over halfway through the page. The faith in the order of nature, which has made possible the growth of science, is a particular example of a deeper faith. This faith in the order of nature cannot be justified by inductive generalization. Why not? Well, you remember Hume's problem with induction? you see. That inductive generalization beyond present experience involves the principle of causation of which we have no empirical evidence. Well, he's going to come back to that later on. He anticipates it here. That faith in the order of nature cannot be justified by any inductive generalization. It springs from direct inspection of the nature of things disclosed in our immediate present experience, concrete experience. That's where we get the idea of an order in nature. The fact that day succeeds day. That your roommate is relentlessly the same. And so forth. There's no parting from your own shadow. It's there all the time. I am I. To experience this faith is to know that in being ourselves, we are more than ourselves. To know that our experience, dim and fragmentary as it is, yet sounds the utmost depths of reality. To know that detached details, merely in order to be themselves, demand that they should find themselves in a system of things. To know that this system includes the harmony of logical rationality, the order of nature, the harmony of aesthetic achievement, there's that value achievement. To know that while the harmony of logic lies upon the universe as an iron necessity, the aesthetic harmony stands before it as a living ideal, moulding the general flux in its broken progress towards finer, subtler issues. Hey, he waxes eloquent from time to time. Indeed he does. Okay. Page 54. Flash on to that, and you get it again. Almost halfway through the page, in the context, he's talking about Newton's physics. Okay? And about Locke, who's writing with a knowledge of Newton's physics. He says, but the mind in apprehending also experiences sensations which, properly speaking, are qualities of mind only. These sensations are projected by the mind so as to clothe appropriate bodies in external nature. Secondary qualities are subjective. Okay. Thus, the bodies are perceived as with qualities which in reality don't belong to them. Qualities which are, in fact, purely the offspring of the mind. Thus, nature gets credit that should, in truth, be reserved for ourselves. Isn't that a cute way to put it? The rose gets credit for its scent, the nightingale for its song, and the sun for its radiance. But according to Locke and the Newtonian tradition, the poets are entirely mistaken. According to Whitehead, the poets are mistaken. They should address their lyrics to themselves and should turn them into odes of self-congratulation on the excellency of the human mind. Because nature is a dull affair, soundless, scentless, colourless, merely the hurrying of material endlessly, meaninglessly. Okay. You see, he's talking here of aesthetic values. Nature is devoid of all aesthetic value if secondary qualities, the aesthetic qualities, colour, smell, sound, if aesthetic qualities are subjective, you see, then the world in itself has no aesthetic value. You see, doesn't have any colour, smell. And since you cook up the world of that by projecting your secondary qualities, you should congratulate the cook. Congratulate yourself. Okay. That couldn't be much more plain than that. Well, you'll see that all the way through. That sort of theme, and I'll come back to it later. Okay, in chapter 2, the chapter on mathematics, mathematics in the history of thought. He talks about the order of nature And of course, in the Platonic and Pythagorean tradition, that was conceived to be a mathematical order, as it was in Descartes and much of modern science. That's why a theoretical physicist I got to know a few years ago did his work with the slide rule. Physics with the slide rule. Yes, because nature has a mathematical order. Yes. I don't know if he does it with the slide rule now. I suspect not. He's probably dead long since. But even if he were alive, I suspect it would be some other computer than a slide rule. This notion of a mathematical order, of course, is what in the Greek tradition underlay the theory of forms, real universals, you see. So that what you have is a notion of an eternal range of order, an eternal mathematical order, an eternal logical order. Whereas the things in this world have only vibratory existence. That's his phrase. Vibratory existence. Meaning that they come and go. You see. Vibratory existence. And you can get that in various ways. You'll find him talking about it in talking of John Locke's notion of simple ideas. That is to say, atomistic ideas. So that those constituents of this so-called experience that John Locke talks about come beep, 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 disconnected, and we have to associate them with the psychological principles of association. You see. Combining and separating ideas according to their resemblance, contiguity, whatever it is. What you get is an atomistic view of experience analogous to the atomistic view of the material world in the mechanistic scheme, where matter is composed of indivisible pellets. You see? The atom, our temnos, cannot be split. Indivisible pellets of matter. That being pellets of bare, senseless matter had no relationship to anything else, except incidental spatial relationships. You see? And in a uniform space and time, their own spatial temporal identity doesn't mean a thing. It's only in relationship that's external. So he's talking of the atomistic nature of things and these simple ideas come and go, vibratory existence. You see. Later on, when he gets to talking about quantum physics, he comes back to this notion of vibratory existence because the quanta of energy in quantum physics come and go. You see? And if you think of the life cycle of any organism, primitive or advanced, we come and go, we're biodegradable. You see? Well, the unit of reality in his theme is the event. Events come and go. Vibratory existence. Okay. So this notion then develops. The question is whether this vibratory existence has any meaning or not. And he points out that he's going to change the picture from a mechanistic picture of these indivisible little pellets, you see, to an organic picture, or if you like, an organismic
picture.
The model is not that of a machine, cause-effect mechanisms. It's that of an organism, where the parts of an organism are interdependent.
You see?
They don't have separate existence. They're internally related in the sense that the one is defined in its relationship to something else. That's why it's important to watch what you eat. You see, because of the organic interrelatedness of everything, essentially. So he's going to have an organic model then with internal relationships rather than a mechanistic model with external relationships. You'll find that he talks of atomism and atomistic philosophy. Yes, he has sort of an atomistic view of events. But they're atoms in an organic interrelationship with one another, internally related to each other, growing out of one another. You see, get the genetic notion that we were on last time, that an event has a life cycle. From the initial objective data, which give rise to a new event, through to the final satisfaction, the culmination, which then becomes the thesis for the next antithesis of further objective data, which precipitate another event. You see, like in Hegel, thesis, antithesis, synthesis, and the synthesis then is the thesis for the next thesis, antithesis, synthesis, and the synthesis is a thesis for the next thesis, antithesis, synthesis. All right, Whitehead changes the vocabulary, but does the same thing. So the satisfaction provides the thesis for the next event. It's a vibratory existence, but with internal relationships. Chapter 3 does deal with that problem of induction. And after talking of the difference between a mechanistic model and an organismic model, the difference between atomism with external relationships and atomism with internal relationships, he can now address the problem of induction. Why is induction a problem? Precisely because the moments of experience are unrelated one to another. They are atoms of perception that have no bearing on future experience. There are no internal relationships. So that the association of ideas is by some sort of psychological process, but there is nothing intrinsic to any one idea which means that something else is around the corner. You see? In other words, it was the theory of external relations in Hume's atomistic view of ideas and impressions, which means that you do not, therefore, have any impression of the causal connection between experiences or ideas or events. The causal connectedness would be a relationship, but you don't experience those relationships. All you experience is constant conjunction, sequence. A followed by B. Always A followed by B. Always A followed by B. But you don't see the relationship. The causal connection is unknown. And because the causal connection to what is as yet beyond present experience is unknown, well, how can you make inductive generalizations? How can you, by inductive reasoning, make predictions? So you have a problem with induction. So the problem that he cited at the beginning, that the order of nature, the uniformity of nature, the orderedness of nature, is a presumption that's not empirically proven. You see? And that statement at the beginning is simply a reference to Locke's problem. Now he knows why Locke had a problem. Namely, the wrong scientific abstraction led him down a garden path, created the problem. But as he indicated, in concrete experience, in the immediacy of our own experience, is no problem. So he talks then of this in terms of two fallacies. You see, the critical function is trying to criticize the abstractions. And he finds two fallacies here, the fallacy of simple location and the fallacy of misplaced concreteness. Now, the fallacy of simple location is the assertion that things have fixed locations in space and time. That if here is a spatial field, things have fixed locations just like that. Simple location. That is to say, you think of their location as abstracted from everything else. You see. Whereas in reality, these locations are defined in terms of relationship to other things. And by the time you bring the time dimension into the notion of spatial location, then obviously there is no simple location. You see, in terms of the relationship between these three points, if in the process of time this is moving that way, and this is moving that way, and this is, say, stationary, then what you say about the relationship between point A and point B is going to be different at different times. And what you say about C being in relationship to A and B, makes it even more confusing. You see. It's just that there are no such things as simple locations, because of movement in time. Because space is just a pattern of relationships. Nothing more. You see, he's getting at the relativity of space-time. So then, the fallacy of simple location. Second is the fallacy of misplaced concreteness. You see, concrete, abstract, those are the antitheses. Misplaced concreteness is when you give concrete existence to an abstraction. You see, and the idea of a fixed point is an abstraction that doesn't exist, because everything is in change, motion. So the idea of a fixed point is an abstraction, a fallacy of misplaced concreteness. The idea of an event without internal relationships to other events is an abstraction. So in constructing a scheme in which you have events or atoms of that sort, misplaced concreteness. And there's nothing that could be said about you that's worse from Whitehead's standpoint that you engage in the fallacy of simple location or the fallacy of misplaced abstraction. Those are the unpardonable sins. philosophical. Yeah, and his reason for this is that they fail the test of empirical adequacy. Because abstractions of that sort are just not adequate to concrete experience. You see, so that criterion of empirical adequacy which he has in testing abstractions comes into play in that way. Okay, on that topic, take a look at page 50. Page 50. Bottom of the page, the new paragraph. Are you following all right? Okay. Bottom of the page, new paragraph. This simple location of instantaneous material configurations. Simple location of instantaneous material configurations is what Bergson has protested against. Well, you've read a bit about Bergson in Stumpf.
Okay.
Another process philosopher. As far as it concerns time, yes, Bergson stressed relativity of time. He protested against it so far as it's taken to be the fundamental fact of concrete nature. He calls it a distortion of nature due to the intellectual spatialization of things. I agree with Bergson. But I don't agree that it's a vice necessary to the intellectual apprehension of nature. Bergson thought it was. And in subsequent lectures, I'll endeavor to show that this spatialization is the expression of more concrete facts under the guise of very abstract logical constructions. There's an error, but it's merely the accidental error of mistaking the abstract for the concrete. An example of what I call the fallacy of misplaced concreteness. Then the next paragraph, it's at once evident that the concept of simple location is going to make great difficulties for induction. Induction. For if in the location of configurations of matter throughout a stretch of time there is no inherent reference to other times, past or future, it immediately follows that nature within any period doesn't refer to nature at any other period. Accordingly, induction is not based on anything that can be observed as inherent in nature. There's no broader reference than to the present. Thus, we cannot look to nature for the justification of our belief in any law such as the law of gravitation. The order of nature cannot be justified by the mere observation of nature. There's nothing in the present fact which inherently refers either to the past or the future. It looks, therefore, as though memory as well as induction would fail to find any justification within nature itself. You may notice there is some sort of a similarity between Hegel's literary style and Whitehead's. I was commenting to somebody the other day that whereas in people like Locke and Descartes, you take a paragraph and you tend to have a succession of ideas that logically follow one from the other, step, 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 step. In Hegel, what you have is a thesis statement at the beginning of the paragraph and then a mulling around in that concept for the rest of the paragraph. You see? And that's what you have in Whitehead. It's the same sort of thing. Then you have this business of misplaced concreteness. At the bottom of that page, he talks of two correlative categories of substance and quality and calls these misplaced concreteness too. Well, those of you who were here the last day before break when we were talking about F.H. Bradley, why do you laugh at that one? Those of you who were here, yeah. Not half of you, two-thirds of you were here when we were talking about F.H. Bradley. F.H. Bradley explicitly rejects such dichotomies as sheer abstraction, substance quality, so forth. In the preface to his Process and Reality, Whitehead lists all of the things that he takes to be sheer abstractions, and that list corresponds pretty well to Bradley's list. It's in that context that he says he is taking Bradley's metaphysics and translating it onto a naturalistic basis. You see, the same abstractions, though what they take to be the concrete reality is different. Chapter 4 critiques the 18th century thinking, where the antithesis of mind and bare matter is another sheer abstraction. Whitehead, it turns out, has a double aspect theory, so that any event has both its physical and its conceptual aspect. Now, you recognize that if you hark back to the analysis of an event. And in his analysis of an event, to the idea of prehension, which is the way in which, in a process, objective data come into the act by what he calls physical prehension, physical causation. What in conscious perception is consciousness of a stimulus, of a physical stimulus. And in addition to that, it's the way in which eternal objects, those eternal possibilities, come into the act by conceptual prehension. So that you have two kinds of prehension, physical and conceptual prehension. So that every event has these two sides to it. You see? That is to say, it has, on the one hand, its internal relatedness to other events which are pending. Perhaps I should say impending, not impending, but impending. I-N. It has that relationship. It also has a relationship to the logical possibilities that poses. The conceptual prehension, which in conscious thought are conceived possibilities, thought possibilities, ideas. So in that sense, every event has these two aspects. Every event of human consciousness has those two aspects, the physical and the mental, as we call them. Now, to say that that means there are two substances, as Descartes said, mind-body dualism, you see, misplaced concreteness again. All we have empirically in concrete experience is the event and the two aspects of the event. The concrete eye is two things out of two aspects of an event. Invokes a substance, quality, distinction, which is sheer abstraction. So his critique goes that way. He therefore is critical of both Descartes' dualism and metaphysical materialism, where there is one substance, matter, one kind of substance, and metaphysical idealism, if that's an idealism of mind substance, spiritual substance, as in Berkeley. So any metaphysic of substance, he repudiates, because concrete experience is about events. We don't have empirical basis for the other. Now, it's also in chapter 4 that he gets at the atomism business and the internal-external relationships a little bit more. You'll notice on page 64, 65 through to 72, 73... He points out that in talking of whether atoms or events, the 18th century writers speak of the separative character, of space and time. So that things are separated in space, separated in time. That's involved in the atomism notion. Space and time separate us, one from another. Now, he maintains that's just a part of the story, not the whole, and insists that space and time, in addition to having a separative character, also have a prehensive character. Prehensive. Yeah, that is to say, prehension, whether it's physical or whether it's conceptual, is of the very nature of an event. You see? So that space-time events are interrelated by physical prehension. Yeah. To the very nature of things. The causal connectedness is intrinsic to the whole notion of an event. There wouldn't be an event without objective data intruding. Yes, so this sort of concern becomes extremely important. Look on 69 and 70. You get the initial notion of this on 64, but on 69 and 70 you get some other stuff that's related to this. Let's see. The word perceive in our common usage is shot through with the notion of cognitive apprehension. So is the word apprehension, even with the adjective cognitive omitted. So I use the word prehension for uncognitive apprehension. apprehension which may or may not be cognitive. Now, take Euphranor's last remark. This is in one of Berkeley's writings. It's not plain, therefore, that neither the castle, the planet, or the cloud which you see here are the real ones which you suppose exist at a distance. Accordingly, there is prehension. It's plain that's the case. There's a prehension here in this place of things which have a reference to other places. What you see here are the real ones that exist at a distance. Prehension is both separative and space is both separative and prehensive. Well, Berkeley's sentences contend that what constitutes the realization of natural entities is being perceived. Yes, to be is to be perceived. Remember Berkeley? Well, we can substitute the concept that the realization, the reality, is a gathering of things into the unity of apprehension. To be is to prehend. Not to be is to perceive or to be perceived, but to be is to prehend or to be prehended. You see? So Berkeley had a clue, but he misread it. You see. What is realized, the reality that comes into being, is the prehension, not the thing. God's thinking doesn't make things. It makes prehensions. And then on 70, the end of that paragraph, halfway down the page, concrete fact is process. Its primary analysis is into underlying activity of prehensions, into realized prehensive events. Each event is a matter of fact, individual matter of fact, issuing from an individualization of substrate activity. Not substrate stuff, but activity. Individualization does not mean substantial substance independence. So forth. I guess that'll do it on that. Then you get the romantic reaction, chapter 5. And I urge you to enjoy that. It's very significant. But after the poetry, the philosophy becomes more explicit even. So that on page 89 and 90, he gives three reasons for rejecting the subjective idealism of Berkeley. Three reasons. About 12 lines down on 89, one reason arises from direct interrogation of our perceptual experience, naive experience. In sense experience, we know away from and beyond our own personality. Yeah. What I see here now is something there. Here, there. Concrete experience, you see. What he's appealing to there is what we'll run across in some of his contemporaries like G.E. Moore in the analytic tradition, the recognition of intentionality, or what is sometimes called a mental act in perception. Locke had said that in perception the mind is passive. A blank tablet, just registering sense impressions.
You see.
Not so Whitehead, not so G.E. Moore and others. The mind is active, it's reaching out. We give attention to, we refer to, we select within for attention.
You see.
So that mental act of external reference, of spatial reference, of time reference, is ingredient to ordinary language, concrete experience. Again, saying that Locke's description of experience and its constituents is mistaken description, just ain't true. All right, so you get that then on page 89. The second reason at the bottom of 89 is that our historical knowledge tells us of ages past, when, as far as we can see, no living being existed on Earth. It tells of countless star systems. In other words, there's good reason for something more. And the third reason on page 90, about eight lines down, is based upon the instinct for action. Just as sense perception gives knowledge of what lies beyond individually, so action seems to issue an instinct for self-transcendence, acting beyond my subjective ideas. Now, you say, yeah, but Berkeley knew all about this and he had his explanation. Well, you see, here, it seems to me, his Whitehead's argument is not in terms of empirical adequacy. Berkeley covers this sort of data. The argument is in terms of rational coherence. You see, which gives the more obvious unifying, meaning-giving explanation. An appeal to a coherence criterion for truth. So that the reality of other space-time entities outside of any mind seems to make much more sense, to fit much more naturally with the concrete experience that we have of history, of action, and of mental intentionality than is the case of Berkeley's speculative abstractions. So rational coherence. And then on 93 and 94, he begins to get where he was going all the time, at the bottom of 93. Remembering the poetic rendering of our concrete experience, we see at once the element of value, of being valuable, of having value, of being an end in itself, of being something which is for its own sake, must not be omitted in any account of an event as the most concrete actual something. Value is the word I use for the intrinsic reality of an event, the satisfaction achieved. You see, value is an element which permeates through and through the poetic view of nature. We've only to transfer to the very texture of realization in itself that value which we recognize so readily in terms of human life. Next page, value is the outcome of limitation. That is to say, of all the eternal possibilities, value is achieved when those possibilities are narrowed down to what is actualized. Okay. So aesthetic attainment in terms of limitation. And if you read his chapter on God, which is a brief chapter, chapter 11, you'll find that that chapter treats God as the principle of limitation. The principle of limitation. Look over to that, if you would. Page 191, 190, oops, that's not 191. Page 178, I beg your pardon. Page 178. Let's see, he says, the beginning of the middle paragraph, there's a further element in the metaphysical situation. There's required a principle of limitation. Get that? Some particular how is necessary, some particularization in the what is necessary, some principle of limitation. We must provide a ground for limitation which stands among the attributes of substantial activity. This attribute provides the limitation for which no reason can be given. Yet why amidst the boundless possibilities is there one selected for actualization? You see? All reason flows from this. God is the ultimate limitation. His existence is the ultimate irrationality, in the sense that you can't give reasons for God emerging. It is the existence of God that is the reason for the actual entities emerging that do emerge. You see, and the activity of God. God is the ultimate limitation. For no reason can be given for just that limitation which it stands in his nature to impose. God is not concrete, he is the ground of concrete actuality. No reason can be given for the nature of God because that nature is the ground of rationality. And you remember I talked of that in terms of what he says, not here but in his later works, of the threefold nature of God. You see? A God in the mode of God in his primordial nature, you see, is the unity of all conceptual possibilities. God in his consequent nature is God is affected by all events which he prehends. God in his superjective nature is God holding out possibilities to new events in the world. You see, and it's by that superjective nature that he's the principle of limitation. Well, that's as far as we have time to go. The two chapters I omitted, 7 and 8, have to do with electromagnetic field theory, quantum physics, relativity theory, which are the scientific basis for the position he's taking. You see? Because they talk of internal relationships. They talk of relativity of space-time. They talk of events rather than mechanistic things. So the combination of the two, concrete experience, modern science. I miscalculated time. I wanted time for you to feed back on this. Okay, we'll start.